Welcome back to the Deep Dive, where we take complex information, stack up the sources, and extract those essential nuggets of knowledge to get you well-informed fast. I'm Alex Smith.
I'm Taylor Johnson. Mm-hmm. Our mission is to be your expert guides, helping you cut through the noise to understand not just what's happening, but why it truly matters.
Today, we're embarking on a fascinating deep dive into something that impacts every corner of American life, yet often goes unnoticed, the Federal Register. Specifically, we're going to unpack the Federal Register for Tuesday, August 12, 2025.
Right.
Think of it as the daily journal of the U.S. government, where agencies publish their official rules, proposed rules, and notices. It's dense, yes, but within its pages are the blueprints for major shifts in our economy, our freedoms, even the products we buy and how we send our mail.
Exactly. And we'll show you how these, you know, seemingly obscure legal notices can ripple out to profoundly impact your daily life and what these seemingly disparate actions reveal about the forces shaping our nation.
Yeah, it's not just dry legal stuff.
Not at all. It's a living, breathing window into the machinery of government. From new regulations affecting businesses, to subtle shifts in foreign policy, to even the specific types of fish you can catch, understanding its contents offers a unique kind of unfiltered perspective on the forces shaping our world.
And we'll be going through today's edition piece by piece, extracting the most vital information, discussing the immediate and long-term implications, and helping you connect the dots.
That's the plan.
So what does this all mean for you? Let's peel back the layers and discover just that. Okay, before we dive into the specifics of today's edition, maybe let's quickly set the stage. What exactly is the Federal Register and why should people care? Why is it so important?
Sure. So the Federal Register is the official daily publication for rules, proposed rules, and notices of federal agencies and organizations. It also includes executive orders and other presidential documents.
Okay.
It's published Monday through Friday, except on official holidays, by the Office of the Federal Register. It's all mandated under the Federal Register Act.
So it's essentially how the public gets informed about government actions, almost like an official daily newspaper for federal policy. Is that a fair way to put it?
Precisely. It provides a uniform, centralized system for making regulations and legal notices available to the public. This covers everything from presidential proclamations and executive orders to federal agency documents that have general applicability and legal effect, and even documents that Congress requires to be published. It's legally significant, too. Under the law, 44 U.S.C. 1507, its contents are judicially noticed.
What does judicially noticed mean, practically?
It means courts are required to accept the contents as fact without needing further proof. So if a rule is published in the Federal Register, it's considered established law in any legal proceeding. It gives it immense weight.
Wow. Okay. That underscores its foundational role then.
Definitely.
And how can someone access this, say, if they were curious after our deep dive? Is it hidden away somewhere?
Not at all. Not anymore, really. You can access it in print or microfiche if you really want to go old school.
Right.
But most commonly now, it's online for free at www.govinfo.gov. That's a service of the U.S. Government Publishing Office.
And it's updated daily.
Yep. The online edition is updated by 6 a.m. each publication day. And it includes text and graphics going all the way back to March 14th, 1936. So it's not exactly a new thing.
No kidding.
But its modern digital accessibility ensures that this critical information is broadly available. It's actually a pretty good testament to transparency in government when you think about it.
That's quite a history. It really underscores how foundational this document is. Okay, let's start with the big ones today, presidential documents. All right, let's unpack this section. Today's Federal Register includes several presidential documents. Let's begin with the Memorandum of June 30, 2025, titled Reissuance of and Amendments to National Security Presidential Memorandum 5 on Strengthening the Policy of the United States Toward Cuba. This sounds like a significant shift or maybe a reinforcement of policy.
It is, yeah. This memorandum, NSPM 5, it's a reissuance and amendment of a prior directive from back in June 2017. Its main purpose seems to be strengthening the U.S. policy toward Cuba, particularly highlighting ongoing human rights concerns. The language is pretty strong.
So what are the key abuses this updated policy is targeting specifically?
Well, the memorandum explicitly condemns quite a range of severe abuses. It calls out the arbitrary detention of dissidents and peaceful protesters, the terrible prison conditions they face, and the violence and intimidation used against them, noting it happens with impunity. It also highlights retaliation against families of political prisoners just for peacefully protesting, harassment of worshipers, and the denial of basic rights like free speech and internet access. The document very clearly states that the United States condemns these specific abuses.
Okay, so doubling down on human rights, that's clear. But what about the economic or travel aspects? Those always seem to be in flux with Cuba policy. How does this memo balance pressuring the government versus, you know, helping the Cuban people?
That's always the tricky part, right? This is where it gets particularly interesting. While the memo aims to deny resources to the Cuban government, it says it also seeks to empower the Cuban people.
Oh.
Well, to do this, within 30 days, the Secretary of the Treasury, working with the Secretary of State, has to start a process to adjust current regulations. The goal is to ensure adherence to the statutory ban on tourism to Cuba. So it looks like tighter enforcement of existing tourism restrictions.
But practically speaking, how does the U.S. monitor that distinction, given how the Cuban economy works? Are there specific mechanisms to stop funds diverted from tourism from still benefiting the regime somehow, or is this mostly symbolic?
Well, the intention seems practical.
Yeah.
For instance, the amended regulations will require educational travel. It has to be for legitimate educational purposes, under the banner of a U.S. organization and accompanied by a representative from that organization, unless, that is, it was a type of educational travel allowed before January 27, 2011. There are also explicit directives for auditing travel to Cuba to ensure compliance with these new, tighter rules, and regular reports from the Treasury Inspector General on how those audits are going.
So more oversight, more paperwork for certain types of travel.
Exactly. The aim is to make sure only approved non-tourism travel that genuinely supports the Cuban people, not the government, gets through.
What other changes target the Cuban government specifically besides travel?
The definition of prohibited officials of the government of Cuba is being broadened significantly.
How so?
It now includes ministers, vice ministers, members of the Council of State and Council of Ministers, members and employees of the National Assembly, provincial assembly members, local sector chiefs of those committees for the defense of the revolution.
Wow, that's granular.
And director generals and subdirector generals and higher within the government. This expands the scope quite a bit, meaning more individuals associated with the Cuban government face U.S. restrictions. Could affect their travel, finances.
So the overall goal is consistency with U.S. foreign policy, national security, protecting sources. It really is a delicate balancing act they're trying to pull off. Isolate the government, help the people.
That seems to be the objective laid out here, yes.
Okay, next up we have Proclamation 10963, National Purple Heart Day 2025. This feels like a deeply significant acknowledgement.
It is. This proclamation recognizes August 7th as National Purple Heart Day. And it actually traces the medal's history all the way back to General George Washington's Badge of Military Merit.
Oh, really?
Yeah, established August 7, 1782 to honor acts of unusual gallantry, extraordinary fidelity, and essential service. So it connects today's recognition right back to the origins of the military.
And today, it's for those wounded or killed in action. What's the specific message behind this year's proclamation beyond just the history lesson?
The proclamation emphasizes that the Purple Heart is, quote, neither pursued nor won, but instead bestowed as a symbol of the sacrifices manifested in bloodshed, broken bodies, and perished souls.
Powerful words.
Very. It's a stark reminder about the involuntary nature of the sacrifices it represents, that our freedom is preserved, often at tremendous cost, by those in uniform. The administration also states a commitment to peace through strength, ending endless foreign wars, and ensuring a powerful military. They anticipate fewer conflicts, but state the significance of this decoration will never be diminished.
So it's both a tribute and maybe a bit of a policy statement on military engagement?
You could read it that way, yes.
Okay.
Acknowledging past sacrifice while setting a strategic direction.
A powerful tribute indeed. Now, turning to economic policy, we have Executive Order 13330, democratizing access to alternative assets for 401k investors. This sounds like it could have a truly transformative impact on retirement savings.
Oh, absolutely. This EO is potentially a seismic shift. It talks about democratizing access to wealth-generating opportunities that were previously pretty exclusive to institutional investors or the ultra-rich. The stated policy aim is to ensure every American preparing for retirement has access to funds that include investments in alternative assets, provided the fiduciaries think it's appropriate. The goal: enhance net risk-adjusted returns and diversify portfolios for everyday people.
Okay, but first, define alternative assets in this context. What are we talking about?
Good question. Basically, these are investments outside of your typical stocks and bonds. Think private equity, venture capital, hedge funds, private credit, maybe real estate.
Stuff not usually in a 401k.
Exactly. They're often less liquid, more complex, and yeah, historically reserved for big players or the very wealthy.
So this is a huge departure. How does the government plan to actually democratize access, given they've been so inaccessible to the average person?
The key mechanism here is the directive to the Secretary of Labor. Within 180 days, labor needs to clarify its position on alternative assets and what the appropriate fiduciary process is under ERISA.
ERISA being the big retirement law.
Right. Specifically for offering asset allocation funds that contain these alternative investments. The clarification needs to identify criteria for fiduciaries to prudently balance the potentially higher expenses, which these funds often have, against the goal of getting greater long-term net returns and diversification.
Okay, so guidance for the people managing the plans.
Yes, and the secretary is also tasked with proposing rules or guidance to clarify fiduciary duties when making these funds available. And interestingly, it mentions potentially including appropriately calibrated safe harbors.
Safe harbors, meaning protection for the fiduciaries.
Potentially, yes. The idea seems to be reducing the fear of ERISA litigation that might discourage fiduciaries from offering these types of investments in the first place.
So more options for savers, potentially higher returns, maybe more diversification, but also potentially higher fees, more risk, less liquidity.
That's the trade-off. It puts a huge burden of due diligence on fiduciaries and could expose savers to new levels of complexity. It's definitely a calculated gamble on democratizing sophisticated finance.
A really big shift to watch. Okay, we also have Executive Order 14331, guaranteeing fair banking for all Americans. The title suggests a focus on fairness in financial services.
That's exactly right. This order aims to address and remove practices that could lead to what it calls politicized or unlawful debanking.
Debanking?
Yeah, it means financial institutions closing accounts or denying services based on non-economic factors or, you know, political motivations rather than legitimate financial risk.
Yeah.
It seems to be a response to concerns about banks potentially wielding influence beyond just economics.
And how does it propose to stop that? Because couldn't this also be seen as limiting a bank's ability to manage its own reputational risk? What are the potential downsides here?
That's a crucial point. The order directs federal banking regulators, FDIC, OCC, Fed, SBA, others within 180 days to remove the use of reputation risk or similar concepts from their guidance manuals, etc.
Remove it entirely.
Well, the stated goal is to ensure reputation is considered solely for a reasonable and apolitical risk-based assessment. Regulators are also encouraged to rescind or amend existing rules that could result in this kind of debanking.
So, trying to force banks to be neutral, purely economic actors.
That seems to be the intent. But you're right, it definitely raises questions about how banks balance this directive with their own assessment of overall risk, especially when public perception can hit the bottom line.
Interesting tension there. So the clear goal is preventing politically motivated debanking.
Yes, and it goes further. Federal banking regulators are directed to take appropriate remedial action against institutions found to have engaged in this politicized or unlawful debanking if it violates existing law.
Like fines.
Could include fines, consent decrees, other disciplinary measures. It's a very clear signal against using banking as a tool for political pressure.
Okay. And finally, under presidential documents, we have Executive Order 14332, improving oversight of federal grant making. This one sounds like it's about spending concerns.
This one is quite pointed, yes. It starts by stating every tax dollar the government spends should improve American lives or advance American interests, and then flatly asserts that this often does not happen.
Strong language.
Very. It's framed as a direct response to perceived misuse of taxpayer funds. And it gets very specific, calling out examples like federal grants funding drag shows in Ecuador, training doctoral candidates in critical race theory, and developing transgender sexual education programs. The language is clearly critical of certain types of grant funding.
Now, this order uses some very specific politically charged examples. How does the Federal Register itself stay neutral here? And what impact might this extra scrutiny have on the types of research that get funded, especially regarding academic freedom?
Well, the Federal Register just publishes the official text. Its neutrality comes from simply presenting the document as written by the executive branch. But the order itself is definitely not neutral in its critique. It highlights a study, and this is according to the executive order, claiming more than one quarter of new National Science Foundation, NSF grants went to diversity, equity and inclusion, and other far-left initiatives, including things promoting Marxism, class warfare propaganda, and other anti-American ideologies.
Wow.
Masked as rigorous investigation.
It also criticizes the efficacy of federally funded science more broadly, mentioning reproducibility issues, data falsification, and the large chunk of grant money going to university overhead facilities and administrative costs instead of the research itself.
So, beyond the ideological points, what's the actual plan? What concrete steps are mandated to address these concerns?
It mandates agencies implement new review processes for discretionary awards, meaning grants. This includes a pre-issuance review by senior political appointees or their designees.
So, an extra layer of political review. It seems so. Involving discussions by grant review panels or program offices. It also requires annual reviews of existing awards to ensure they align with agency priorities and are making progress. And there's an accountability mechanism for the officials involved.
And what about the considerations for discretionary awards part? What criteria are they supposed to use?
Senior appointees are explicitly told to use their independent judgment, not just rubber stamp recommendations.
Mm-hmm.
They have to apply specific principles, focusing on maximizing return on taxpayer dollars, prioritizing research that advances U.S. national and economic security, ensuring scientific integrity, and protecting free inquiry and academic freedom while avoiding conflicts of interest.
Okay.
And it also directs limiting funds for those facilities and administration costs. So the order clearly aims to reorient federal grant making towards specific national interests, as defined by the administration, and away from spending it deems wasteful or ideologically driven.
Okay, quite a set of directives from the executive branch today. Let's move on from presidential actions to the rule section. These are final regulations. They have the force of law. First up, a temporary rule from the National Marine Fisheries Service, NMFS, part of NOAA and Commerce regarding Atlantic highly migratory species, Atlantic bluefin tuna fisheries, closure of the angling category Gulf of Maine area trophy fishery for 2025.
Right. This is a classic example of in-season management. NMFS is closing the angling category, Gulf of Maine area fishery, for the big ones, large, medium, and giant, or trophy, Atlantic bluefin tuna. That's fish 73 inches curved fork length or greater.
Okay.
This applies for the rest of the 2025 fishing year, starting basically immediately, for vessels with HMS Angling or HMS Charterhead Boat permits fishing recreationally.
So no more trophy bluefin fishing in the Gulf of Maine this year for recreational anglers. Why the sudden closure? Did they hit the quota really fast?
Looks like it. The rule's effective 11:30 p.m. local time, August 12, 2025, running through December 31st. It's being issued because the sub-quota for that specific category angling, Gulf of Maine, trophy BFT, is projected to be reached very shortly.
Ah.
Delaying the closure would mean exceeding the quota, which could then lead to future cuts for this category, or maybe even others, depending on how much they went over. This kind of quick action is crucial for managing these highly migratory species.
And it sounds like they're closing other size classes at the same time, too, not just the trophies.
That's correct. NMFS is also simultaneously closing the angling category fishery for the smaller ones, school and large school, small, medium, bluefin tuna. Those between 27 inches and less than 73 inches.
So basically the entire recreational bluefin fishery in the angling category is closed now for the year.
Exactly. For BFT of all size classes in that category, it's a comprehensive closure to make sure the overall angling category quota isn't blown. Vital for the long-term health of the stock.
Makes sense. What's the legal basis for this and why no prior public comment? That usually raises eyebrows.
The action is taken under the Magnuson-Stevens Act, and it's consistent with the Atlantic Tunas Convention Act,
sure,
which implements recommendations from ICCAT, the international body managing Atlantic tunas.
Right.
As for the public comment, NMFS found good cause to waive the prior notice and comment period because it was deemed impracticable and contrary to the public interest.
Why impracticable?
Because of the unpredictable nature of bluefin tuna availability, their migrations, the fact the fishery was actively underway, and the quota was about to be hit now. Waiting for comments would have meant guaranteed overfishing.
Okay, so immediate action needed to prevent harm to the resource.
Precisely. Any delay would undermine the conservation goals and potentially hurt future fishing opportunities. It's that trade-off between public input and urgent resource management.
A classic example of dynamic management. Okay, let's move into proposed rules. These are where the public does get a chance to comment before things become final. We have a proposal from the Federal Aviation Administration, FAA, regarding Bombardier Inc., docket no, FAA 2025-1732, project identifier MCAI 2024-00SU49-T. Sounds like a safety directive.
It is. It's what's called an airworthiness directive, or AD. The FAA is proposing to amend the regulations 14 CFR Part 39 by adding a new AD for several Bombardier aircraft models.
Which ones?
Specifically, the model CL-600-1A11, that's the 600, the CL-600-2B-16, which covers 601, 604, and 605 variants, and the CL-600-2C-10, the 650 variant, mostly business jets.
This proposed AD deals with the nose wheel steering potentiometer universal coupling set screws. Sounds technical, I know.
A bit, yeah.
Basically, these set screws need to be replaced. If they fail, it could compromise the plane's ability to steer on the ground. That's obviously a safety risk during taxi takeoff and landing.
Definitely. Is there a deadline for this replacement? Yes. If this AD becomes final, operators of these specific planes would have to replace the set screws within 36 months, or 1,400 flight hours, whichever happens first, after the AD's effective date.
Okay, a clear time frame.
And the replacement has to be done following specific Bombardier service policies, which are incorporated by reference into the proposed rule.
What are the broader implications for the operators beyond just the cost of the parts and labor?
Well, the FAA estimated the costs. The manufacturer might cover some or all under warranty, but it's still a mandatory maintenance action for continued safe flight.
Right.
The FAA issues these ADs under its authority to promote safe flight. This one isn't considered a significant regulatory action under the relevant executive orders, nor does it trigger other acts like SBRIFA or UMRA, meaning its overall economic impact isn't expected to be huge across the industry. It's a very targeted safety fix.
Got it. A specific safety measure for specific jets. Okay, next we have a fascinating one from the U.S. Postal Service, USPS, regarding postmarks and postal possession. This touches on something many of us probably take for granted.
Yeah, this proposed rule aims to clarify how the Postal Service uses postmarks and what information they actually convey. It's a direct response, they say, to the prevalence of third-party uses of the postmark to confirm that an item was sent by mail or as evidence of the date of mailing.
Which raises a huge question for me and probably many others. I always assumed the date on the postmark was the date the post office got my mail.
Yeah.
You know, rushed to the mailbox before the last pickup to get that day's date stamped on it for a deadline.
You and millions of others. And for a long time, that was generally reliable. But here's the critical part, the real shift. While the date on a machine-applied postmark often coincides with the date USPS first accepted possession, they are, quote, not always in alignment.
Not always.
And in fact, this lack of alignment will become more common with the implementation of the Regional Transportation Optimization RTO initiative. This is a fundamental change in how we need to think about postmarks.
Okay, tell me more about this RTO thing. Why does it cause this misalignment? What's the trade-off? Is it just cost savings?
RTO consolidates mail collection and drop-offs onto single transportation routes. USPS says this saves money and cuts carbon emissions, aligning operations with the big drop in single-piece first-class mail volume.
Makes sense from an efficiency standpoint, but the impact?
The impact is timing. Under RTO, pickups of originating mail stuff dropped in collection boxes or at post offices would generally occur the day after such volume is tendered to the Postal Service by a customer.
The day after?
Generally, yes. So if you mail something on Monday, the machine postmark applied when it gets processed might actually show Tuesday's date. If you mail on a Saturday, it might not get processed until Monday, meaning a Monday postmark. A two-day difference.
Wow. So if you're mailing a tax return, a bill payment, a legal document with a strict postmarked by deadline, relying on that free machine-applied postmark is suddenly really risky.
Exactly. The critical takeaway is that the trusty postmark, long considered definitive proof of mailing date, is fundamentally changing due to these operational shifts.
So what does USPS suggest people do if they need undeniable proof of the mailing date, like for those critical deadlines?
Well, they remind the public about services you can purchase, things like certificates of mailing, registered mail, and certified mail.
The paid options.
Right. These provide an actual receipt proving the exact date USPS first accepted possession of the mail piece. That's crucial now for time-sensitive stuff.
Yeah.
They also explicitly caution that things like pre-printed labels from self-service kiosks or online postage.
Like click and ship?
Yeah, or meter strips. Those only show when you bought the postage or printed the label, not when USPS actually accepted the mail piece. A critical distinction.
That is a huge aha moment. Really changes a common understanding. And comments on this proposed rule are due by September 11th, 2025. Definitely something for people to be aware of.
Absolutely. A subtle but really significant shift.
Okay, Let's move into the notices section. This is always a broad category: trade disputes, science, environmental actions, financial regs. Let's start with the International Trade Administration, ITA, at Commerce. Looks like a busy day for trade actions, anti-dumping, AD, and countervailing duty CVD stuff.
Yeah, quite a few today. These cover preliminary results, final orders, and even new investigations. Just a quick refresher. AD duties target foreign companies selling goods in the U.S. below fair market value or cost that's dumping. CVDs counteract foreign government subsidies that give their companies an unfair advantage. Both aim to level the playing field for U.S. industries.
Got it. So what are some specifics today?
Okay, first, there's an update to preliminary results for an AD review on certain superabsorbent polymers from South Korea. This references some recent court opinions that affected how they define the scope of the order. These reviews keep existing duties current.
All right. What else?
Then there are preliminary results for an AD review on wooden cabinets from China. Commerce is actually rescinding the review for 49 companies, either because they had no shipments or withdrew the request properly. It also mentions the separate rates analysis for non-market economies like China. Companies have to prove independence from government control to get their own rate. Otherwise, they get the higher countrywide rate.
So, ongoing monitoring and adjustments. Are there any new duties being finalized?
Yes. There are final AD and CVD orders being issued for certain brake drums from China and Turkey. This follows positive final determinations from both Commerce, finding dumping and subsidies, and the U.S. International Trade Commission, finding material injury to the U.S. industry.
So tariffs are going on those brake drums now?
Correct. Entries of those brake drums will now be subject to cash deposits at the calculated rates. The notice specifies exactly which types are covered.
Okay, and it looks like they're also starting new investigations, particularly in the solar sector.
Yeah, exactly. The U.S. is initiating new AD and CVD investigations into crystalline silicon photovoltaic cells, solar cells from India, Indonesia, and Laos.
Interesting. Why now?
This follows petitions from the domestic industry alleging dumping and subsidization. Commerce found enough information to start the investigations. This could lead to new duties on solar cells from these countries down the line if the allegations are proven and injury is found. It definitely signals concern about trade practices in that crucial sector.
A lot happening there. Anything else on the trade front?
Just a couple more quick ones. An amendment to final AD results for light-walled rectangular pipe and tube from Mexico, essentially rescinding the review for 11 companies that didn't ship during the period. An amended final AD and CVD determinations and orders for certain low-speed personal transportation vehicles from China, think golf carts and similar vehicles. This corrects some minor errors and confirms duties are officially in effect now.
That's a whirlwind of trade policy, affecting everything from chemicals to cabinets to solar panels to pipes to golf carts. Really shows the detailed, specific nature of these actions. Okay, let's shift gears from trade to environmental protection. We have a notice from NMFSNOA, again, titled Takes of Marine Mammals Incidental to Specified Activities. Taking marine mammals incidental to the Office of Naval Research's Arctic Research Activities in the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas, Year 8.
Right. This is the Office of Naval Research, ONR, asking for a renewal of their Incidental Harassment Authorization, or IHA. This allows them to potentially take marine mammals, meaning harass them incidental to their Arctic research activities.
Which are considered military readiness activities.
Yes, yeah. Under the Marine Mammal Protection Act, MMPA. This is specifically for a renewal extending an existing IHA for an eighth year. So it points to a long-term research program in that very sensitive Arctic environment.
What species are we talking about, and what kind of take? Does harassment mean actual physical harm?
The request is for authorization of level B harassment only.
Level?
Yeah, which generally means behavioral disruption, like causing an animal to change its swimming direction, alter its vocalizations, or maybe temporarily leave an area. It specifically does not mean serious injury or mortality, which aren't expected here. The species covered are the Arctic stock of ringed seals and the Beaufort Sea and Eastern Chukchi Sea stocks of beluga whales.
Okay, behavioral disruption. And what Navy activities might cause this?
The activities involve active acoustics, using sound-generating devices for research, and also ice-breaking by the research vessels. Both can create underwater noise that might disturb nearby marine mammals.
Seems like a tricky balance in the Arctic. What measures does ONR have to take to minimize these impacts?
There are several required mitigation measures. Vessel crews have to stay alert, operate at safe speeds to avoid collisions. During acoustic source use, there's a 55-meter mitigation zone they have to shut down if a marine mammal enters that zone. Vessels also have to avoid head-on approaches and maintain larger standoff distances, 457 meters for whales, 183 meters for other marine mammals, if safe to do so. They also have to stop activities if they see unauthorized species, or if they reach the authorized species, take limits for the approved species.
Anything else?
Yes. Importantly, they must maintain communication with subsistence hunters in the area to avoid conflicts. And all vessels must have at least one trained marine mammal observer on watch during activities using Navy training programs.
Okay, so quite a few protocols in place to try and manage that balance between research needs and protecting marine life. Comments on this renewal are due August 27, 2025. Now, speaking of military matters, let's look at direct aid. A notice from the Defense Department on arms sales, specifically transmittal number 2453, about a proposed letter of offer to Ukraine.
Right. This notice details a request from Ukraine to buy sustainment articles and services for their HAWK phased-through missile systems. These are air defense systems. The total estimated value is $138 million.
And it's funded how?
Through Foreign Military Financing, or FMF. That means the U.S. is essentially providing the funding for Ukraine to make this purchase. It's facilitating the sale to bolster their defense capabilities.
What does sustainment-related articles and services actually include for the HAWK system? Is it just spare parts?
No, it's quite comprehensive. It includes engineering and integration for communications and interoperability, making sure the HAWK systems work with Ukraine's other defense systems.
Crucial.
Yeah. Also, refurbishment and system overhauls of the HAWK fire units, components for missile recertification, toolkits, test equipment, support equipment, technical documents, spare parts, training for Ukrainian personnel, and U.S. government and contractor technical support in the field. It's about keeping these systems viable long term.
Okay. The policy justification says it's for Ukraine's defense against Russia, obviously. But it also mentions an emergency exists requiring immediate provision. What does that mean for the process? Is it bypassing normal steps?
That's a critical point, yes. The Secretary of State has certified that an emergency exists under Section 36B1 of the Arms Export Control Act. This waives the normal congressional review requirement for arms sales.
Ah, okay, so it speeds things up dramatically.
Exactly. The stated reason is to provide Ukraine as soon as possible with defense articles needed for the war. This emergency certification indicates a perceived urgent need by the executive branch, streamlining the approval due to the ongoing conflict.
Got it. Moving to infrastructure, we have a couple of notices, one from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, about an application from Nueva Era Dos, LLC.
Right. This notice announces an application by this company for a new project. FERC usually handles things like interstate natural gas pipelines, LNG terminals, maybe some electric transmission. The notice sets a deadline for interested parties, landowners, environmental groups, communities to intervene in the process.
And it outlines the environmental review.
Yes, it says within 90 days, FRC staff will either complete their environmental review or issue a schedule for it. This is the standard process to allow public and agency input on major energy projects.
Okay. There's also a notice about information collection from the Western Area Power Administration, WA, related to the Central Valley Project in California.
Yeah, this notice is about WAPA collecting payments from Central Valley Project CVP power contractors. These payments aren't just for power. They specifically fund environmental habitat restoration and improvement as mandated by the Central Valley Project Improvement Act of 1992.
Interesting link between power and environment.
Definitely. The notice details how they calculate late payment charges, 0.05% daily, and how the money gets transferred to the restoration fund. It also describes an annual reconciliation or true-up process to correct any under or overpayments by the power contractors based on energy exchanged.
Fascinating. A clear example of using infrastructure contracts to fund environmental work through detailed accounting. Okay, let's touch on health and human services. A notice from HHS, Office of the Secretary, titled Findings of Research Misconduct. Sounds serious.
It is. This notice publicly announces a finding of research misconduct against someone named Ryan Evanoff, formerly a scientific assistant at Washington State University.
What did they do?
The misconduct occurred in research funded by the Public Health Service, specifically an NIAA grant from NIH. As a result, he's been debarred for 3 years.
Debarred meaning?
Barred from receiving any federal funding. This public notice serves as a record of the federal action against scientific fraud and reinforces research integrity standards.
Okay. Now, from the Housing and Urban Development Department, HUD, regulatory waiver requests granted for the first quarter of calendar year 2025. This suggests some flexibility in housing rules.
Yes, exactly. This notice details several waivers HUD granted, showing they can bend the rules when needed. One significant one allows Kentucky to use the statewide median income instead of the local area median income, AMI, for determining eligibility for CDBG disaster recovery funds related to those 2021 and 2022 disasters.
Why is that significant?
Because in disaster areas, local AMIs might be very low, potentially disqualifying people who still desperately need help. Mm-hmm. Using the statewide figure ensures more people in those hard-hit counties can qualify for assistance. It streamlines recovery.
Makes sense. Any other interesting waivers granted?
Yeah, another one temporarily helps certain low-income credit unions, LICUs. It lets them count specific types of debt or capital towards HUD's net worth requirement, provided their main regulator, NCUA, also allows it. This helps these LICUs stay compliant with HUD while maintaining their well-capitalized status, letting them continue serving their communities.
Good example of interagency flexibility.
And there were several waivers for public housing agencies, PHAs, dealing with presidentially declared disasters in 2024 and 2025. These provide administrative flexibility, like waiving the rule about verifying income within 60 days before issuing a voucher, or waiving strict unit size requirements.
Why waive those?
To get families housed faster after a disaster. Documentation can be lost or hard to get. Housing is scarce. These waivers cut through red tape in emergencies.
Very practical. Okay, next, an important notice regarding strategic investments. Agency information collection activities, proposals, submissions, and approvals from the Small Business Administration, SBA.
Right. This notice proposes a new information collection, specifically targeting small business investment companies, SBICs, licensed under the new SBI Critical Technologies, SBICCTs initiative.
SBICCTs.
Yeah, it's a joint effort between the SBA and the DoD's Office of Strategic Capital. Indicates a strong national security focus.
What's the goal of this SBICCT initiative?
The main goal is to attract and scale up private investment into small businesses, developing technologies, components, or production processes deemed critical to U.S. national and economic security. It's about steering private capital towards strategic areas.
Okay. And why the new information collection?
To ensure compliance and, importantly, to prevent capital deployment that might be inconsistent with the public benefit or national security. These SBICCTs will have to report more information than standard SBICs.
What kind of extra information?
Two key forms mentioned are SBA Form 1030 for foreign ownership, control, and or influence FOCI risk assessments, help screen for problematic foreign ties, and SBA Form 1032. A supplemental questionnaire about their investment activities.
And they have to file these regularly?
Yep, quarterly. Within 45 days after the end of each quarter, it shows a heightened, ongoing scrutiny to make sure these investments align with national security goals.
Very interesting. Another crucial notice, this time from the State Department. Two related notices, actually, about the Balochistan Liberation Army, BLA. One amending its specially designated global terrorist, SDGT, designation, and another designating it as a foreign terrorist organization, FTO.
Right. These notices formally designate the BLA under both categories, SDGT and FTO. These are very significant legal designations.
What are the consequences?
Major legal and financial ones. All their property and interests in property subject to U.S. jurisdiction are blocked. U.S. persons are generally prohibited from having any transactions with them, and providing material support to the group becomes a criminal offense. It's a clear U.S. government action aimed at disrupting the group's finances and operations globally.
Okay. And from the Office of United States Trade Representative, USTR, a notice about Russia's implementation of its World Trade Organization commitments.
Yes, USTR is asking for public comments to help prepare its annual report to Congress on Russia's compliance with its WTO obligations.
What does the report cover?
It looks at whether Russia is adhering to various WTO agreements, things like import regulations, domestic subsidies, technical barriers to trade, intellectual property rights, transparency, the whole gamut.
And the purpose of soliciting comments?
It helps the U.S. government identify areas where Russia might not be fully complying. This allows USTR to plan actions to encourage improvement. They specifically encourage small businesses to comment, recognizing that these global trade issues affect them too. Comments are due October 1st, 2025.
Got it. From the Transportation Statistics Bureau, BPS, another notice about agency information collection activities, proposals, submissions, and approvals, preservation of records. Sounds like data retention.
It is. BTS is asking for comments on whether they still need to require certificated air carriers and charter operators to keep various records for set periods.
What kind of records?
Things like detailed accounting records, consumer complaint letters, reservation reports, aircraft movement system reports. Public charter and military charter operators also have to keep specific contracts, invoices, receipts, bank records for 6 months after the charter. Other records have longer retention, some up to 3 years.
Why keep all this?
It ensures oversight, transparency, and data availability for regulatory compliance and statistical analysis in the airline and charter industry. Standard procedure, but they periodically review if the requirement is still necessary.
Makes sense. All right, let's shift to financial regulation. Several notices today from the Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC. First, one involving NASDAQ IS, LLC, about its short-term option series program. Sounds like it affects how options are traded.
That's right. NASDAQ IS is proposing to expand the types of short-term options it lists. Specifically, they want to allow listing up to 2 Monday and Wednesday expirations beyond the current week.
For all stocks?
No, only for options on what they call qualifying securities. These have to be very large, actively traded stocks market cap, over $700 billion, or large ETFs assets under management, over $50 billion. Plus, they need significant monthly options volume.
So more flexibility for trading options on the biggest, most liquid names.
Exactly. The proposed Monday expirations could open for trading on a Friday or Monday for expiry the following Monday, provided there isn't already a standard option expiring that day. Same logic for Wednesdays.
Why the change?
The exchange believes it meets demand for more short-term trading flexibility on these specific high-volume underlines and won't cause market disruptions based on experience with existing daily expirations. They note they didn't receive any comments opposing this when it was initially filed.
Okay. And another from the SEC involving Cboe BZX Exchange, Inc., about amending its fee schedule to offer unitized logical port sets. Sounds like trading tech fees.
Correct. Cboe BZX is proposing a new pricing structure for connecting to its trading systems. These unitized logical port sets bundle resources. They're implementing an ascending tier structure.
Meaning?
The more port sets a trading firm buys to connect, the higher the rate per set becomes.
That seems counterintuitive. Usually you get a discount for buying more.
Yeah, but the exchange argues it encourages efficiency. Firms won't oversubscribe to ports they don't need. It also ensures that firms using more system resources pay more rather than spreading that cost to smaller users. They say it's about managing finite system capacity fairly and claim their pricing is still competitive, even lower than some competitors like MIAX exchanges. It's an example of exchanges constantly tweaking fees.
Interesting approach. Moving to investment products, we have a notice from NYSE Arca, Inc. about listing shares of the Innovator Total Private Credit ETF.
Yes, this proposes listing and trading a new actively managed ETF. This one, the Innovator Total Private Credit ETF, plans to invest primarily in private credit assets.
We talked about private credit earlier with the 401k order. What kind is this ETF holding?
These are described as short-duration, high-yielding loans sourced through fintech lending platforms. So trying to package loans made via online platforms into an ETF wrapper.
What are the implications of investing in private credit this way, especially regarding liquidity? That's always the challenge.
It's significant. The filing says the trust will maintain a liquidity sleeve, about 20% of its assets in liquid holdings to manage redemptions. The other 80% is in these private credit assets, which are structured to pay back about 8% of the trust's assets under management per month in cash.
So they expect cash flow to handle most redemptions.
That's the plan. The advisor expects to fulfill most redemptions using the liquidity sleeve and reinvesting those monthly cash flows. However, the filing acknowledges that in a worst-case scenario, the trust could temporarily suspend redemptions.
Suspend redemptions? Wow.
Yeah, though they expect such a suspension wouldn't last longer than about 2.5 months because of the incoming cash flows from the short-duration loans. It offers investors access to this typically illiquid asset class, but with specific mechanisms and potential risks like suspension to manage that illiquidity. Diversification is cited as a benefit due to the small loan sizes.
Definitely something for investors to understand fully. And another ETF notice from NYSE Arca, listing options on the VanEck Bitcoin ETF.
Right. This proposal is to list and trade options on the VanEck Bitcoin ETF, which, unlike futures-based ETFs, directly invests in Bitcoin itself. This is another step integrating crypto into traditional financial products.
And they're proposing position limits.
Yes, position and exercise limits of 25,000 same-side option contracts for this ETF. That limits how many contracts one entity can hold.
How does that 25,000 limit compare to options on other ETFs?
The exchange calls it conservatively proposed. They say it's based on the ETF's volume, shares outstanding, and market cap, over $7 billion back in March 2025. They specifically state this limit is significantly lower, between 2 and 10 times lower than average limits for options on comparable ETFs.
So being cautious with a new volatile asset class.
Exactly. The reasoning is to ensure market integrity while still allowing options trading. A deliberate, cautious step towards broader integration for digital assets.
Okay. And one last SEC notice. Cboe EDGX Exchange, Inc., amending a rule about volatility and long-short exchange-traded products.
This one concerns products linked to VIX futures, contracts those tied to market volatility. The exchange is proposing to eliminate a 10% participation cap that certain funds previously adhered to during the rebalancing periods for VIX futures contracts.
A 10% cap? What was that for?
The sponsor of these funds had committed to that cap originally to minimize the fund's impact on the VIX futures market during rebalancing and potentially reduce volatility within the product itself.
So they're removing that safeguard. Why? And what does it mean for investors?
The sponsor now states that the fund's rebalancing may vary from the index methodology depending upon market conditions and other circumstances, including the potential impact on VIX futures prices. They also say the sponsor can vary the rebalancing manner and periods for all funds it sponsors to limit participation during market illiquidity. They expect extended rebalance periods, mostly during extraordinary market conditions.
So less predictability.
It seems so. The exchange argues it's not an undue burden on competition. But this change gives the sponsor more flexibility, especially in volatile times, potentially at the cost of predictability for investors. How these products rebalance could become less transparent or consistent.
Something else for sophisticated investors in those products to track. Okay, finally, a notice from the Office of Foreign Assets Control, OFAC, within the Treasury Department. Notice of OFAC sanctions action.
Right, this is OFAC publishing the names of individuals and entities newly added to its specially designated nationals and block persons list, the SDN list. This is a major enforcement tool.
And the consequence of being on the SDN list is?
All property and interests in property of these persons that are subject to U.S. jurisdiction are blocked. And U.S. persons, individuals, and companies are generally prohibited from engaging in any transactions with them. It cuts them off from the U.S. financial system.
Can you give us a few examples of who was added this time and why?
Sure. This batch includes various individuals and entities, mostly shipping companies. They were designated under Executive Order 13902, which targets Iran's economy, especially its petroleum sector.
Okay.
For example, companies like Oka Shipping, Inc. and Draco Buren Shipping, TLTD, were designated for allegedly materially assisting or providing financial support to an already designated individual, Mohammad Hossein Shamkhani, or for operating in Iran's petroleum sector. Several individuals were also named, like Hector Varela Dilion, Anil Kumar Panakalarian Nair, and Pankaj Najipai Patel, for roles like operating in the petroleum sector or being linked to designated entities.
So part of the ongoing effort to pressure Iran financially.
Exactly, by disrupting its financial networks and its ability to export oil, hitting their revenue. This shows the immediate, direct impact these financial sanctions have on global individuals and companies.
Wow. A very direct application of foreign policy through finance. What a deep dive. Seriously, we've covered a huge amount of ground today. From the really intricate world of options trading and financial regulation, the strategic flow of military aid, to the surprisingly complicated realities of your daily mail.
Right. Who knew the postmark was so complex now?
Exactly. And those really profound impacts of presidential executive orders on everything from how we save for retirement to foreign grant funding to trying to ensure fair banking practices.
And let's not forget those crucial regulatory actions. Protecting marine mammals in the Arctic, how energy projects fund environmental habitat restoration, and all that critical trade enforcement work trying to ensure a level playing field. The Federal Register really is this daily testament to the vast, varied work of the government, stuff that's often quietly shaping the world around us.
It's just fascinating to see how these seemingly small updates or technical clarifications buried in legalese can have such wide-ranging implications. Or how a single signature on an executive order can try to redirect billions in funding or completely redefine foreign policy overnight.
That really is the power and the purpose of this document. It distills all those details that eventually trickle down and affect businesses, industries, and individuals across the country. Often, like you said, without us even realizing where it started, it takes a real deliberate effort to track it.
So what does this all mean for you listening? As you go about your day, maybe thinking about your 401k or mailing that important bill or just seeing news about international trade, Maybe consider this. How many other crucial decisions and developments are being published almost silently in these daily government records? And what might you be missing by not knowing where these fundamental details are found?
It really raises an important question, doesn't it? In this age of constant information overload, where can you find the most reliable, the most impactful details about the actual decisions shaping our nation? The Federal Register, yeah, it's dense, it's not light reading, but it stands as a truly foundational source. It offers that direct, unfiltered glimpse into the very core of our regulatory and policy landscape.
Well, we hope this deep dive into the Federal Register for Tuesday, August 12, 2025, has given you a fresh perspective and equipped you with some truly unique insights into that process. Join us next time for another deep dive into the world of complex information.
Until then, stay curious.